You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White. Mark Arex is an award-winning journalist and author. He's reported extensively on how the water history and future of California has been shaped by the battle between powerful agricultural interests and large cities. Mark Arex sat down with CapRadio Reads host Donna Apodoni to talk about his latest book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Here's an excerpt of that conversation. Mark starts by talking about how he first became interested in California water rights.
My grandparents, after we sold the last ranch along the San Joaquin River, they moved to a suburb in Fresno called Fig Garden. And three houses down was this huge irrigation canal. And my grandmother made me promise that I would never go near it.
Why?
She said, "Do not go near it. It's got a magical power to it. It will lure you up and into the waters, and you will drown." And she said, "And no one will come to save your body." And don't get the wrong idea about my grandmother, but I said, "Why not, Grandma?" She said, "Because the flow of one irrigation canal is much more important to the valley than the body of one silly boy." And in a way, that was true. I mean, there were times when particularly Mexican kids they would swim there, they would drown, and their bodies wouldn't be recovered for months, because to recover would mean to shut down that flow. So I had a sense that something was strange, but I never bothered to ask, you know, where that water was coming from, where it was going, and to whom and by what right. That's when I had a sense.
Fascinating. So we start with snowmelt, and we have streams and rivers that come into the valley, and we have an aquifer. Which part of that is most related to the politics of water?
Well, let's start with the proposition that the men who took this land from the natives, 300,000 natives, and they were wiped out by three kinds of invasions. First, the Spanish invasion, and then Mexico for a time, and then Sutter coming in, and I do a whole chapter on Sutter. When the Americans take over, they decide that they're going to declare the entire edge of this continent, 1,000 miles long, as one state. And that right there was a bit of hubris, but it also put a challenge in front of them. How do you make the parts of that state equal when there are actually 8 different states of nature within? And that's where the proposition came that we need to move the rain. And it started with the gold rush. The mining of gold was really the mining of water first.
Subsidence is a big part of what you write about. The sinking of the land, which we don't think about, and it might be more evident in parts of the state than it is in others, but there are parts of the state where the land has sunk a lot.
No, the aqueduct itself, they pumped so much water out in this last drought that the aqueduct, there are 4 or 5 pools of it that have sunk so much that the gravity flow is no longer working. And we're all spending hundreds of millions of dollars in electricity to try to get that water, pump it through its dead spots. And right now along the Frying Kern Canal, which is, the aqueduct is on the west side, the Frying Kern Canal is on the east side. Part of that has sunk so much, it's not serving, going all the way to Bakersfield the way the water used to. And there's some bills right now in the legislature to spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to fix that problem. It's interesting that there's going to be no contribution from the irrigation districts or the farmers who did the pumping.
There are canals all over the country. There are dams all over the country.
When you're saying country, you mean the country.
I mean like the U.S.
Oh, you mean the U.S. Okay.
I don't mean rural areas, that kind of country. I mean, but all over every country, dams and canals are a part of how we get water from one place to another. What makes the Central Valley different and what makes it not the best situation?
It's not to the extent that it is in the valley. We altered the landscape. There's geological studies that show this. We alter the landscape in the San Joaquin Valley more than any place on Earth. And we did it through scrapers. We did it through land levelers. So it's a dramatic alteration of the land. And then we took these rivers and we made them run backward.
When people in other states look at California and they look at some of our environmental laws and practices, when it comes to pollution of the air, for example, and how we handle that, people from other states look at us and say, wow, you know, they really take it to the extreme there. But, you know, if you think about it, it's pretty good. They're doing some really good things, and maybe we're not going to follow or copy California, but, you know, we tip our hats. We see that California's in a good direction for them. When it comes to water, I don't know what people are saying in other states, but it doesn't seem like we're being very progressive.
No, we're one of the last states to regulate groundwater, the pumping of it. It took us 165 years. There's a character in this book about midway through. His name is Harding, Sidney Harding. He's a professor at UC Berkeley. And to make a little extra money, he goes to work for the state in summer during the summers, and he works for farmers and consults. And he starts putt-putting in his little Model T Ford down the valley in the 1920s, and he discovers the seeds of a disaster. The farmers have just taken this new turbine pump, and they're going deeper and deeper into the earth to bring out water because they've already used up the flow of the rivers, and now they need the flow of the aquifer to grow farmland even more. And he's warning, he's like a Cassandra, he's warning that this is going to be a real problem. You can't chase that water all the way to hell. But they ignore him. And it's not until 100 years later that we see the wisdom. So yeah, when people say California is very progressive and we're on the cutting edge of environmental stuff, that did not apply itself to groundwater.
I didn't understand at first some of the changes that have taken place in what people have farmed, what people have grown. And I talked to a retired farmer, and I said, well, what did you grow on your land? He said, what year?
Yeah.
What? It has changed a lot. The crop, the product has changed dramatically over the years. Because of water or because of demand?
No, because of price. I mean, no one can change faster than a farmer. I mean, you know, he's pulling out. You know, I can take you to certain fields in the valley that began as wheat and then became a vineyard for raisins, and then it was tree fruit, and then it's nuts. And there's no almost sentimental kind of thing about it. It's just, yeah, my dad and grandpa, they grew vines for 100 years, but look at the price of almonds, and you're seeing that conversion happen all the time. So you're right, as soon as they notice that change, the first farmer that follows, the rest of them follow through. And then what happens is that crop becomes a glut. Mm. The price goes down, and then the reinvention happens all over again.
You also observed something else in terms of politics that you wrote about that surprised you a little bit, that a farmer actually talked about those two bad words, climate change.
Yeah.
And that wasn't something that they talked about before. Now they're coming around, they're using the term a little bit more freely.
Can I tell a little story?
Please.
I won't make it too long. So the apricots in my backyard in the middle of the drought started blooming in January, early January, and it was really weird. And it was a nice heavy bloom, and they set heavy, and I thought, I was already counting the mason jars. You know, I was going to make my Armenian sun jam. And then one morning in March, I went out and I looked, and the trees were weightless. And all the nubs of those apricots were at the floor, thousands of them. And so I called up one of my farmer friends. And we have a fun game. He farms about 8,000 acres of things. And I always compare my experiments in my backyard with his 8,000 acres. And he just shakes his head and says, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I said, Brad, you have to come see my apricot trees. It was like a mass shedding, and I can't figure out what. And he said, let me show you my nuts. So he picked me up, and we drove to his pistachios. See, pistachios need to be fertilized. So for every 24 females, there's one male. And these guys have a funny sense of humor, these farmers. They paint the trunk of the pistachio rooster red. So he's spanking all the pods on the males, and no pollen is coming off, and he can't figure it out. He says, I've never seen my orchard out of sync like this. And I said, well, what is it? And he kind of scuffed his boots, and he said, it's climate change. Pretty bold for a farmer to say that. And so what was happening in my little backyard orchard there, in his big orchard, was the same thing. We did not have enough chilling hours in the winter to put those trees in hibernation. You have to be asleep. You have to kind of touch death as a tree to then produce life in the spring. And that's what was happening. And that kind of is, actually, that happens in chapter one. So it's kind of a mystery story that propels you through the narrative. And I find a couple of these devices, because most of the water books I read kind of put me to sleep. And so I didn't want anybody falling asleep in this book. Even though it weighs 2.2 pounds, I hope that it keeps you going. So these mysteries were a way to carry the narrative forward.
Mark Arax, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you. I just felt...
The Drent Land.
That's Mark Arax speaking with Donna Appadoni about his book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Make sure to subscribe to the Cap Radio Reads podcast now, and you will get the full version of that conversation in your feed later this summer. We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.